This is the BBC.
Hello and welcome to the Westminster Hour podcast for Sunday, the 10th of September. I'm Carolyn Quinn. With news that the government's to agree to wage rises for police and prison officers, which breach the public sector pay cap that's been in force since 2010, we'll be getting the views of my panel, the Tory James Cleverly, who's a parliamentary aide to the Immigration Minister, and Jenny Chapman, who's on Labour's Brexit team. Also with us, commentator Ian Martin and The Telegraph's Kate McCann. As we look ahead to crunch votes this week, tomorrow on the EU withdrawal bill and Tuesday on the membership of standing committees. And we bring together the former Chancellor, Lord Darling, and the top official at the Treasury until last year, Lord McPherson, to reflect not just on the essential relationship between the minister and the Mandarin, something that we'd like to explore with other pairs of ministers and mandarins as well. But they're also specifically going to be looking at the moment 10 years ago when there was a run on Northern Rock, queues outside branches, and the financial crisis was just unfolding. We start tonight with a story that's developed over the last few hours, in fact. BBC News understands that the government's about to breach the 1% public sector pay cap that's been enforced since 2010 by agreeing wage rises for police and prison officers. You'll remember last week the Scottish government signalled that it would ease the pay cap there next year. Earlier this morning, Labour had announced that it would be using a day set aside for a debate of its choice this week to push the issue. Here's the Shadow Health Secretary, Jonathan Ashworth, talking to Neil Paterson on Sky News.
We're bringing a vote to the House of Commons on Wednesday, and those Conservative members of Parliament who have sincerely said they believe the pay cap should go, we're calling on them to vote with us, and I'm calling on your viewers to lobby those Conservative members of Parliament and let me know what they say.
But we can put an end to the pay cap on
Wednesday for the NHS staff if they vote with us.
So pointing to the debate on Wednesday. Well, the TUC's General Secretary, Frances O'Grady, is giving her main speech to Congress in Brighton tomorrow, in which she'll repeat her calls for the government to scrap the public pay cap. And she'll say that long-term single market membership is the best option for working people in Britain. And in an interview you can hear on our website, Nick, now Lord McPherson, who served as the top official in the Treasury until last year, warns that a pay cap is unsustainable in the long term, but the government has to count the costs of lifting it.
Generally, pay caps aren't sustainable in the long term, so the government does need to find a way of getting off this policy. On the other hand, it does cost money, and what I would be asking the Prime Minister and indeed asking Mr. Hammond is, well, if you're going to relax policy in this area, how are you going to pay for it? What tax are you going to raise? What spending are you going to cut? Or are you just going to let the deficit remain at an unacceptably high level?
That's the former Permanent Secretary at the Treasury, Lord McPherson, and you can hear him in conversation with Alistair, now Lord Darling, the former Chancellor, later in the programme and in a longer version on the Westminster Hour website. Let's look at that issue then of public sector pay and the understanding that the government's agreed to wage rises for police and prison officers. James, you've caved into the pressure then, have you?
The Prime Minister has always said, and in fact the Chancellor has always said, that we will look at the recommendations of the various public sector pay award bodies. And most of those for the, in fact all of those, for the last few years have recommended 1% pay rise increases. The police and prison service have been recommended to have more than that, and the government's looking at the implications of that. Now, none of us...
These recommendations have been made many times before, though, and haven't been accepted. I mean, the pay cap's been in place
always,
since 2010.
Yeah, but,
and so why move now?
And it's all it is absolutely about the balancing pressures. I mean, we don't want, no government wants to put financial pressure on public sector professionals, and we know that they have been really feeling the pinch financially. And the desire to ease that pressure is counterbalanced with the desire to make sure we keep the economy going. Now, I don't know what announcement may or not be made. I've not heard any definitive answer from that. But ultimately,
it might have been pushed along its way by the fact that Labour were planning to have this debate on this very issue on Wednesday.
This is a line of attack that Labour deploy pretty much every day. It's a non-binding vote on Wednesday. And the government, if it makes an announcement, as I don't know for definite that it will, if it makes an announcement, it will be because those two countervailing pressures, the desire to relieve the pressure on public service professionals versus the desire to keep the economy on track, will have, you know, that those are the things that will have informed the decision.
Jenny Chapman, a government in listening mode then,
really?
Realising that now is the time.
How charitable of you. I mean,
leave the pay cap to one side.
I think the election changed everything, and the government had a huge shock in June, and they realised, I think, that the things that we'd been saying for some time about public sector pay were actually true, because they were hearing it from their constituents, and it affected the way that people voted. Now, the fact that we've got an Opposition Day debate on Wednesday, the fact that we only need, I think, 7 Tory MPs to decide to listen to their constituents and vote with us on this issue, I think that that has had a very real and immediate impact on the way that ministers are thinking. I think it's very, very encouraging that they've spoken about the police and about prison officers especially, because there is a real crisis in our prisons right now. But we're seeing, you know, this isn't just public sector workers feeling the pinch, as James says. This is real hardship for families up and down the country. There was a survey out recently that 1 in 8 public sector workers is skipping meals in order to make ends meet. You know, this is serious. This is having a huge impact on recruitment and retention.
And of course, the question for both of your parties is how you pay for lifting the cap. As Lord McPherson said, a long-term cap is unsustainable, but how do you balance the books? How do you tackle the deficit? What spending cuts do you introduce or tax rises?
Well, we had this out in our manifesto because we would have undone some of the tax breaks that have been given to the better off. And we'd also be £1 billion ahead of where the government is, because there is no way we'd have done this sweetheart deal with the DUP. So all the calls that we normally get from the Tories about, oh, you know, how would you pay for it? You're irresponsible with spending. None of that washes,
James,
anymore.
That shows a fundamental misunderstanding of how public spending works.
Well, the government that's about to change its mind, James.
That £1 billion, which was negotiated as part of the confidence and supply deal with the DUP, is £1 billion of public spending. You can't say, oh, we would use that £1 billion for public spending by not using it for public spending. It's being used for public spending. You can't spend it twice.
No, well, and we can't win the election that we just had.
Let me bring Ian Martin in.
We would not have spent that £1 billion for that purpose.
When you hear the news this week, what do you think?
Well, I think it's clear why the government is shifting, because it's going into a very difficult autumn and winter, where I think it effectively fears something equivalent to almost a winter of discontent, because you have changes coming on welfare, implementation of universal credit, problems around NHS funding. And I think this is just about them realising that they lack a majority and that they're under pressure from Labour, that they have to start moving on some of these issues and anticipating them, so they don't really have a choice.
And James, just in a sentence, is it, in your view, the right thing to do and lift it across the board?
No, these things have got to be done in a balanced way. As I say, no government, whatever their political complexion, wants to put unnecessary pressure on our public servants. But for all the desire to do right by them, it's got to be done in a way which is economically sustainable.
Kate McCann, let me bring you in here, because Labour presumably now will be capitalising, saying that they have been putting pressure on the government and on Conservative MPs. Those Conservative MPs as well who've been calling behind the scenes on Theresa May to do something on this. It looks like their view has prevailed, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a slightly more complicated picture than this just being down to Labour holding a debate on Wednesday, actually, because that debate is about nurses' pay and this conversation is about prison officers' pay and police. And there have actually been quite a lot of Conservative backbenchers who've been making this point in the House of Commons publicly. It's not a secret that there are a number of Conservatives who would like to see the public sector pay cap looked at again. what we're talking about here is the government sets the terms of the public sector pay bodies review. So the pay bodies themselves are not allowed to say we would like 4%. It's the government that decides on those terms. And those terms are going to be changed. And it's worth pointing out as well, prison officers have already seen above 1% increases precisely because there is a problem with recruitment and retention. So I think this has been a shift over a period of time. I don't think it's as simple as Labour's debate on Wednesday. And I do think Ian's right. It's a sign that Theresa May is being forced to listen to her own party as much as other parties, because actually she's about to go into a conference season where she will face a number of difficulties, and she's keen to get her party back on the issues of the day and not just talking about Brexit.
Let's have a look at one of the immediate issues coming up, tomorrow's vote, the second reading of the EU withdrawal bill. Have you got any signs from any Conservatives that they'll be joining Labour in voting against that second reading?
I would be very, very surprised. I think we heard Ken Clark today saying that he thinks it's now hopeless trying to block Brexit. This is, of course, after Tony Blair had come out and said, you know, stand with me, stand tall, and if you oppose it, then oppose it in public. I actually also think it would be surprising if there were a huge number of Labour MPs who voted. So obviously Labour has decided to vote against the bill. I would be surprised if there were very many Labour MPs who voted with the Conservatives. There will be some, but I don't think there'll be very many, because I just don't think there's a huge amount to gain from doing that.
But Joni Chapman, there are Labour MPs who feel that this is a betrayal of the referendum result. I mean, your constituents in Darlington, for instance, who voted for Brexit, they hear not just Labour's latest position on Brexit, which is stay in the single market and customs union during transition.
During transition.
But also that you are saying now we will vote against this process, which has to be taken to just make some sense and avoid all the black holes as we approach Brexit.
We need a process to avoid the black holes, and we do need to take EU law into UK law. Everybody agrees with that. This bill, though, this bill is it's legislative garbage. It is a power grab
by
ministers.
Constituents, though, when they will hear is that Labour, having shifted positions up to now,
they will hear that
going
from
to
the
vote
Tories.
Against
of
this.
Course, the Tories are going to say, "Here's our bill. We've called it the withdrawal bill. If you vote against it, you're voting against withdrawal from the EU." That isn't the case. We're voting against a power grab bill. This will give ministers to take away, behind closed doors, they'll give them the power to take away rights that the Labour Party has fought for 100 years. Why would we do that?
I just think, Jenny, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's actually not just Conservatives who are saying that you would be betraying your constituents, particularly in the North and the Midlands. Your own housing minister, shadow housing minister today, John Healey, has said it sends the wrong signal to Labour voters that if you vote against this bill, it shows that you are trying to frustrate Brexit, which is something Jeremy Corbyn promised in the election that he wouldn't do.
That isn't the case, because voting against this bill has got really not a lot to do with Brexit. This bill is about taking... The reason we're against this bill is that it gives powers to ministers to take away rights of our constituents, and we think that that is wrong. Now, had the government listened to what we said in July, which was, look, we can't vote for a bill in this sort of form. What we want you to do is, we understand that the changes need to be made. We understand that there may be many technical changes that can be done in committees, but what we want is not for ministers to have the ability to change primary legislation unaccountably behind closed doors. It's not necessary for Brexit to do it that way.
What about Tony Blair's latest intervention? I wonder what you make of it. Him saying today he believes Britain could stay in the EU, meet people's legitimate grievances if it negotiated some sort of emergency break on benefits and registered people moving in and out of the country. Our journalists, first of all, what was your initial reaction from both of you?
I just think it's really illuminating just how little clout he has. And I think Kate's right. One of the most important interventions since the referendum was by Ken Clark today. And when he shot down Blair's claim that Brexit was stoppable, you can sense there that something has really shifted. And I think it's an unfashionable view. Incidentally, I should say I'm delighted, as someone who voted for Brexit, to hear parliamentarians arguing over executive power, excessive executive power. For decades, stuff came over from Brussels and just went almost straight into UK law. And I didn't hear many complaints at the time, other than from a few Brexiteers. But I think Blair, it illustrates that I think he's really on a slightly different planet. There's a small group of people around him who think that this is stoppable. And it seems to me almost fantastical. If the ultra-Remainer idea is that Barnier and Juncker are the process and you can't go round them to Merkel and Macron to try and get a proper, sensible, compromise, grown-up deal, which is the only way a deal's going to happen properly, that is deemed impossible by ultra-Remainers. But somehow Tony Blair, through his just magical skills, is going to convince Macron and Merkel to do some sort of deal that sort of keeps us in the European Union. It sounds to me completely bonkers.
James Cleverly, he's come up with a couple of suggestions. I mentioned a few, suggesting EU nationals should have a job in order to live in the UK, without which they'd be unable to rent property or open a bank account. You've had that suggestion from Tony Blair. You also had those early Home Office proposals run up the flagpole earlier this week, proposing that Britain would end free movement of labour immediately after Brexit and limit the number of low-skilled workers. Now, I wonder, first of all, your boss, who is the Immigration Minister, will he be taking notes from what Tony Blair said?
No.
And
Carol,
his reaction then to... Because the Home Office proposals are out there...
No, there was a leaked document, and you know the long-standing convention. I'm now part of the Home Office team. I'm not going to comment on that leaked document, but I can tell you this. If Tony Blair, in the years that he was Prime Minister, had put some of the things in place that he is now advocating, perhaps that some of the pressure in places like Darlington and other parts of the country wouldn't have built to the extent that they did, and perhaps the referendum would have had a very different outcome. So these proposals he's putting forward are a day late and a dollar short, and therefore, as I say, I don't often speak on behalf of parliamentary colleagues, but I'm pretty confident I can say we will not be rummaging through his proposals with a fine tooth comb.
You never know. But look, subsequent governments have had powers at their fingertips to send, for instance, EU migrants home if they haven't got a job after 3 months. Now, why hasn't that been done by Theresa May, either as Prime Minister or when she was Home Secretary? There have been powers that she could have used. Why haven't they been used?
Well, the important thing now is that Brexit gives us...
But why didn't you use those powers?
Well, I mean, as I say, I've just said, I can't speak on behalf of all my parliamentary colleagues.
But the point being
is we're now in a position for the first time in 40 years where we can actually fully define our immigration policy. And I just want to pull up the situation with this EU withdrawal bill before we move too far away from that. The listeners would not have seen me gesticulating wildly whilst Ian was making his point, because he's absolutely right. The hypocrisy of the Labour Party is breathtaking, because for the last 40 years, British law has been changed in a way that it cannot be reversed using secondary legislation, because of instructions
by Europe. All right, but the point that's made is, though, it's fine if it's a benign government who knows what may happen in future.
Now, a benign foreign government.
I'm going to hold it there. I'm going to hold it there because I want to move on with you, Kate, to the other big vote this week, the Standing Committee vote on Tuesday. Now, you know, hold on to your seats.
I was going to say, it sounds so exciting, doesn't it, when you say it like that?
But it's quite significant, isn't it? It's coming up on Tuesday night.
It is significant. So it really does sound incredibly dull, standing committees. I mean, the House of Commons procedure on the floor of the House, it's really one of those things that not very many people understand. I certainly don't really understand it. But the point is, the government is tabling a motion which MPs will vote on, which would allow it to have a majority on committees which consider bills. And they want to do this because they are afraid, if they spend a long time in the House of Commons trying to get things passed with very tight votes, it will then get to a committee and everything will be completely undone and it'll all be utterly pointless and they'll have to start all over again. Now, Labour are really upset about it because they feel that it's undemocratic, and that because Theresa May didn't win the election outright and she has to rely on the DUP, she doesn't have the right to a majority. And that's where we're at the moment. As I say, MPs will vote on it later this week. But it's worth pointing out, this wouldn't be the first time this has happened. It has happened before under another government. And governments with a majority do have the right to a majority on these committees.
Well, that Labour government in the 1970s. So, Jenny, Labour did exactly the same in the 1970s.
And I'm sure the Tories had something to say about it at the time.
You know, it isn't right that the government should want itself a majority on all these committees when it doesn't have a majority in the House of Commons, especially when you think about the withdrawal bill, the role that these committees are going to have in the next few months and years. You know, these committees are very, very significant as we deal with this bill. So we want them to be done fairly. We want them to reflect the House of Commons, because the makeup of the House of Commons is what the country has just decided in June.
So, James,
you were pushing
ahead with this.
The language is really important. The Conservative Party did not win the majority of seats at the general election. But what has just been said, that the government does not have a majority, is factually wrong. The government commands a majority of members of the House of Commons. Otherwise, it wouldn't be the government.
Because of the deal that you've struck with the DUP.
In the same way
it's a
that...
a minority in, government, in the, that's not a majority.
No, the government can command a majority because of the confidence and supply. And to say that something which is about to be voted on by members of Parliament is undemocratic... that's bonkers. The members of Parliament will vote on this issue, and I hope and suspect that they will vote that the government government business will not be tied up in committee because of what would be a nonsense, which is that the whole House could debate something and then a committee could overrule it.
Well, the Conservatives didn't just sit by and let Labour do it in the 70s, so you've got to grant Jenny the right to have a bit of a go about it now. But Kate McCann.
I was just going to point out a wider issue here, which is we've just talked about two process questions. The first one, the withdrawal bill, the second one, the committees issue. And we're talking about why it's fair or unfair for someone to have a majority or vote against it or the process. Actually, the point is the UK will leave the EU in 2019. That's actually not very far away now. And we've got a lot to get through. And the problem at the moment is there's a lot of processology, a lot of questions about how it's going to happen, not a lot of answers about what is actually happening. And I think one of the things that Tony Blair pointed out today, whether or not you like his argument or whether or not you accept he thinks there could be a second referendum, is he's trying to pose solutions. He's trying to start talking about what solutions could be. We may disagree with them, we may not like them, but he's trying to start that conversation. And I think that's something the Labour Party needs to do more of, get a grip of. It's not just say, we don't like this bill, we don't like how it works, we want to see something else. Say what else? Because actually at the moment there is... But there's not been an answer, because we were asking Labour Party officials all this week, what else? What's the alternative? And there isn't one.
But I think that poses a really interesting question about trust, which is that those who voted to leave, I'm a moderate Brexiteer, really are very suspicious of people who claim that they accept the result of the referendum, but then in the next breath, as Blair has done, says that he effectively wants to block the referendum.
Or is trying to...
Or make it easier to get back in.
Or get the best deal possible. That's the alternative.
Yes, but he's working with Andrew Adonis and other Labour peers who are publicly committed to scrapping Brexit. So I think the problem has been since the referendum, what has always been needed is a coalition of interests between moderate leavers and moderate remainers, which is a clear majority in the country for some kind of compromise. To me, that looks like 2-3 years transition, heads of terms on free trade agreement, and then properly out of the European Union, but in a civilised, orderly, sensible way. And I think that can be done, but I don't think anyone's really going to listen to someone who's on the one hand saying that they're trying to be constructive and on the other hand saying we can stop this.
And James, some of your colleagues wrote a letter, didn't they, saying that they didn't want to stay in the EU by stealth. One of your fellow PPSs, who happens to be PPS to the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, signed it, we understand, and was almost on the point of being sacked. Do you think it's right she stays in post?
Oh, I've not heard anything about on the point of being sacked at all. I think I didn't see.
Well, there were questions about whether some people
questioned it, but I've not heard any talk about sackings or anything like that at all. My understanding is the text of the letter was a reminder of the.
I didn't sign it.
A reminder of what was said at the Lancaster House speech, and a reminder. I mean, open letters are always they're always addressed to somebody, but they're designed to be read by everybody. And the point was to say, look, our position is clear on this, as the government's position is clear. We support the Prime Minister's position, and trying to synthesise some kind of, remaining in the EU by stealth, as Ian said, is inappropriate.
Kate, we've got 30 seconds left before we have to move on. So just to say, the late night vote on the EU withdrawal bill is tomorrow night. Then we've got the standing committee vote. On Tuesday, Jeremy Corbyn addresses the TUC. On Wednesday, Jean-Claude Juncker delivers State of the Union address. And Thursday, the Grenfell inquiry gets underway. So there are several other matters for parliamentarians to get their teeth into.
Yeah, there's a lot going on this week. And I think, as we get towards conference season, both parties will want to start looking at things that are not Brexit. They'll want to start talking about housing and student fees, I think, have come up again this week. We'll be in the papers again tomorrow. And public sector pay, of course, a big issue again this week with the debate on Wednesday.
Speculation about the interest rates on student loans perhaps being
And I think we'll see more of this as we get towards the budget and the Conservatives want to look like they're doing progressive things.
Thank you. Well, one of the most important relationships in government is that between a cabinet minister and their permanent secretary, their top civil servant. It was immortalised, of course, in the long-running TV comedy Yes, Minister. But what is the reality? Well, here on the Westminster Hour, we're keen to lift the veil on the inner workings of Whitehall by inviting ministers and mandarins to reflect on their time working together. For the first of this occasional series, I spoke to the former Chancellor Alistair, now Lord Darling, and his former permanent secretary Nick, now Lord Macpherson. Our conversation coincided with the 10th anniversary of the run on Northern Rock and the start of the financial crisis, and you'll hear their memories of that turbulent period. But first, how did Alistair Darling assess the importance of the Permanent Secretary's role?
It's absolutely pivotal. The Permanent Secretary runs the department, and the Permanent Secretary is also the very nature of the appointment is permanent. They're there for a long time. They should have the institutional knowledge that you need, because many of the ideas that ministers come up with, guess what, they've been tried before. And it's quite a good idea to say, well, actually, before you start on this course, these are the pitfalls. So, yes, it is very, very important.
Do you have to get on?
Yes, in any working environment, whether it's in government or anywhere, you need to get on with the people that you work with. I mean, you don't have to be the best of friends. You don't have to be going to the pub after work or anything like that. In fact, there's some merit in having, you know, some distance between you. But if you don't have some sort of empathy, or at least if you don't respect each other, then I don't think the thing could ever work.
Nick, you were principal private secretary in the Treasury when Gordon Brown took over from Ken Clark. I hear that Gordon had a bit of a shock at the regime within the Treasury. I'm told that the idea of going for a drink at lunchtime was a bit of a shock.
I think anybody who has come across in their working lives Ken Clark and Gordon Brown would realise that they have rather different styles of working. Ken, I think, would be the first to volunteer that, as a matter of principle, he was against any meetings before 9:30 in the morning. I think that probably went back to the days when he went to Ronnie Scott's into the early hours of the morning. Whereas I can remember on day one of the Brown regime waking up very enthusiastically and thinking, gosh, I better get in early. I'll get in at 8 o'clock in the morning. Only to discover that Gordon had turned up at the Treasury at 5 a.m. and had required, you know, the security guards to unlock the Chancellor's room. So, yes, it was different. And styles do differ.
Alistair, your first day in the job in June 2007, what were your first impressions of Nick? And do you remember your arrival at the Treasury and then meeting Nick and his first words to you?
You know, when I came back to the Treasury in June of 2007, I remember two things. First was there were three semi-naked women demonstrating outside the front door about what I don't remember. And then I met Nick, of course. And, you know, he was making the point that the vast majority of Treasury staff had never known a Chancellor other than Gordon, because he'd been there for 10 years. And he also went on to say, there's only a few of us who've ever experienced a recession. Now, we laughed about it at the time, but a month later, when the first ripples appeared in the water with Northern Rock, unfortunately, we were about to change people's experience as far as that was concerned.
And yes, the Treasury was, shall we say, ill-prepared for that, Nick?
I think that's a fair assessment, and I take my share of the responsibility for that. And although there were some of us who'd been through the early 90s recession, there were even one or two who'd been through the 81 recession, these were very few in number. It is fair to say that the Treasury, like the Bank of England, like the FSA, didn't have the resources in the right place when the run on Northern Rock took place.
Mm. Alistair, you were talking about June. You came in. Nobody's experienced recession, really, but you were quickly to find that your relationship would be tested in the most extreme of circumstances. I think that's probably fair to say. August 2007, the first signs of trouble, the dawning realisation that all wasn't well with the US subprime mortgage market.
I was on holiday with the family and I was sent to get the morning bread and milk, and I happened to notice a copy of the FT and I thought, well, I'm the Chancellor, I'd better have a look and see what's going on. I bought it and I was standing there waiting for everybody to get up, and I read this report that the French bank Société Générale had wound up, suspended dealings with three of its funds because it couldn't value them anymore because of the subprime crisis. On the same page, there was an article saying one of the German regional banks was in trouble. So I phoned the Treasury and said, if it's happening here, it must be happening in London, because London is one of the biggest financial centres in the world. And I remember it took ages to get someone to tell me what the position was. And when I saw it, it brought me up very short, because I got a list of those banks that we were worried about, and Northern Rock was at the top, but about two or three down was HBOS, which at that time was a very big bank. And that's when I began to think that here's a problem. And of course, that was the beginning of the run up to the run on Northern Rock.
Let's take you back for a moment, both of you, to September 2007, when the Northern Rock crisis was unfolding.
Northern Rock has urged its customers not to panic after enlisting the help of the Bank of England to ride out the crisis in global credit markets. People have been queuing up to withdraw their savings. The company's
so you've just taken out a rather large amount?
I have indeed, yes.
Can you tell me what? How much?
£150k.
£150,000 you've just... Why?
Well, it's just massive steer, isn't it? If everybody's doing what I'm doing, they're going to have to make another loan, and I don't know what's going to happen after that. They could go under.
But you say it's mass hysteria. Do you not feel you're contributing to that mass hysteria by withdrawing £150,000?
Absolutely.
From early morning, savers had been pressing at the doors of many Northern Rock branches, waiting for the banks to open.
When you've got your life savings invested, you want to be sure that they're safe, don't you?
There were lines in Nottingham, Hull and London, across the country.
Well, if they're not in trouble, why are they having to borrow from the government?
Nobody's given an absolute guarantee that the money is safe in this bank.
So Northern Rock in crisis in September 2007, and Nick, the Bank of England stepped in to act as lender of last resort, but that didn't have the desired effect of calming people's nerves, did it? People were queuing around the block to get their money out.
That is right. In one sense, it's a measure of the age of deference being dead. I think 50 years ago, if the government announced the Bank of England was standing behind a bank, people have thought, that's OK. But you listen to those people withdrawing their money, and the Bank of England's support didn't count for very much.
I think we thought that the Bank of England stepping in ought to reassure people. Clearly it didn't, partly, as Nick says, because I think people's confidence in institutions has, you know, shrunk enormously. There's also the effect of 24-hour television, where basically the same queues are shown in a loop, and people are looking at this at home and thinking, well, everybody else is queuing up. And as the man said in your interview there, he went to queue up as well. And it wasn't until the Monday afterwards where I think, frankly, all those that wanted their money out had got it out, and the momentum had come out of the whole thing, that the things subsided. However, you know, Northern Rock was a bad experience for everyone. But if it hadn't been for Northern Rock, I often wonder how 12 months later we would have reacted when RBS, which was the biggest bank in the world and by size was roughly the same size as the British economy, when I was phoned by their chairman to say they'd got less than 3 hours' money left, how would we have dealt with that? Now, the Northern Rock experience meant that Gordon Brown and I and Nick and the Treasury, we were determined that we would do whatever it took to stop another run like that.
So that £500 billion rescue plan, which you signed off, the sums of money involved, Nick, must have had your nerves just jangling when you realised.
I did actually have to sign the odd cheque. And when you look at the number of zeros after the number, you know, that concentrated the mind. So, yes, this was, in terms of magnitude of the country's aggregate income, These interventions were absolutely massive, but they worked. And one of the reasons they worked was that they were well thought out, but they were also well presented by the Chancellor Alistair and Gordon Brown. And coming back to the role of a minister, the critical thing in those circumstances is to have a chancellor who can take decisions and who is calm and can take those decisions sensibly, sequentially and quickly.
What about you then, Alistair? I mean, were you viewing this politically, do you think? Nick was obviously looking at the economic side of it, but in your mind, were you thinking about the presentation and the political side of it as well as the economic?
Well, you need to think about both, actually, because one leads to the other. I had to go to the House of Commons in the afternoon to make my statement. I had to be on the Today programme on the BBC at 7 o'clock that morning, and I had to be confident. I had to say the plan was there, it was working, it was in place, to reassure people, because otherwise the panic you'd seen with Northern Rock would have looked, you know, mild in comparison. Not just Britain, but the world banking system was on the brink of collapse. And just think about it. No cash. People can't buy food. They can't buy petrol. No government could tolerate that sort of thing. So the politics of getting this right and, you know, how you come across on the radio, on the television, and then, of course, in the House of Commons that afternoon was absolutely critical.
Were there disagreements? I mean, it can't have been all sweetness and light between the two of you. There's obviously mutual respect, but you spent an awful lot of time together, didn't you?
But in a good working relationship, you do question each other and you do say, well, are you sure that's right? But, you know, on the fundamentals, it was fortunate that the two of us saw eye to eye, and we also have a very similar way of approaching things, and that, you know, you don't panic, but you just work your way through it, because that's the way you survive. You know, you just, as Nick said, you take your decisions and you get on with it.
Because the picture of the Mandarin and the minister is that it's the Mandarin pulling the strings behind the minister, and the minister goes out and speaks the words. You're the puppeteer. Is that...
Well, maybe I just was working in the wrong department, but it never quite felt like that. I think, look, as a Mandarin, your job is to give the best advice you can. You advise, the Chancellor decides, and once the Chancellor's decided, it's incredibly important for the department really to get behind the decision, help sell it, help make it work.
In all my experience in Whitehall, there's always been occasions when you think, you know, Yes Minister was a documentary, it wasn't a comedy programme. So it is not all like Yes Minister, but equally, you know, as Nick said, it would be a very unhealthy department where everybody agreed with each other.
And Nick, you mentioned other chancellors that you tried to ask to present certain items that you discussed, and it didn't go quite as well as it did with Alistair. I mean, it's quite easy to narrow that down. You haven't worked with that many chancellors, have you? Can you name names?
Well, no. I think discretion is important in when it comes to being a former permanent secretary.
Now, absolutely. Look, what about the relationship between number 10 and number 11? Because there had traditionally been friction between number 10 and number 11 when Gordon Brown was Chancellor. He famously hid his budgets, didn't he, from Tony Blair. Did it make a crisis like this to make the two offices work hand in hand, do you think?
I think in relation to the banking rescue and the financial crisis, we were absolutely at one with each other, you know, and we couldn't have worked without that, you know. Our differences arose really post that, you know, when we're, how do you deal with the economic consequences of that? But, you know, throughout history, there's always been tensions between number 10 and 11. Sometimes they're healthy, sometimes not so. But, you know, that subsists to this day, doesn't it?
In your own words, number 10 unleashed the forces of hell on you following your warning in August 2008 that the world was facing its most serious financial crisis in 60 years. As it turned out, that was a remarkably perceptive analysis,
well,
wasn't it?
To be fair, it wasn't just number 10. It was the Tories. It was most economic commentators. It was just about everybody in the world, as far as I could see. But, you know, there are times when I said that because I'd thought we needed to condition people's thinking about what was going to happen, because a long period of stability and growth had come to an end. When I did that, it was the summer of 2008. It was before the RBS business and so on. And I thought it was rather an obvious thing to say. But if ever you want a lesson in politics, do not say things like that in August.
Alistair gave this interview up in the Outer Hebrides, but when I read it in my Saturday Guardian, I thought this made good sense. So, like him...
Courageous, you mean?
Well, it's courageous, but I agreed with it. The relationship between number 10 and number 11 is difficult. Whoever the government is, inevitably the Chancellor always has a slightly different perspective from the Prime Minister, who's ultimately focused on getting the government of the day re-elected.
So looking back on that period in time, 10 years on, Alistair, are we still feeling the effects of what happened with that banking crisis?
Oh, yes, we are. We live in a much narrower, darker world than we did 10 years ago. You know, I believe that austerity paved the way to Brexit because it just changed the whole outlook. We live in a much more darker world, more inclined to protectionism, to nationalism. And so the political fallout has been absolutely immense. And, you know, we're not through it yet, and we've got the whole of Brexit to deal with. Above all, actually, the biggest thing we need to get right is not fiscal decisions, it's sorting out where we are vis-a-vis Europe. And unless we get a deal, and it's time we had a grown-up conversation both at home where we say to people, look, we're going to have to make compromises, and say to Europe, we don't like it, you don't like it, but we need a new relationship, then we're going to write off another decade, and that would be a tragedy.
Nick, just a final thought from you, because talking about Brexit, can you imagine being inside the Treasury now and overseeing it with every decision coloured, in a way, by the Brexit process? And we know that you have tweeted your thoughts about Brexit. You're not happy about it happening.
My problem is not so much with the Brexit decision. That's been taken. I do share Alistair's concerns about how it's being implemented. I worry about how Whitehall resources are being harnessed and deployed in support of the government's approach. And I feel passionately that this is an area which needs leadership. Someone's got to have a grown-up conversation with the British people about the compromises and trade-offs which have to be made. And sadly, that simply hasn't happened.
That's the former Permanent Secretary to the Treasury, Lord Nick Macpherson, and the former Chancellor, Lord Alistair Darling, giving me a rare insight into the relationship between a cabinet minister and their top mandarin. If you'd like to hear more, then there is a longer version of that interview, the full version, on our website. Jenny, just to pick up on something there, you heard both gentlemen saying that Brexit's a problem and there needs to be grown-up leadership and proper ideas being put forward. And I didn't have a chance to just ask you earlier about those Home Office proposals that have been floated. I mean, you're on the Brexit team. You've got the Home Office leaked proposals saying that there should be tougher restrictions, fingerprinting of new arrivals after Brexit, that there should be time limits perhaps on the number of years that low-skilled workers could stay, a different level of time for higher-skilled workers. What would you make of that sort of proposal if it were put into practice?
Well, the government clearly didn't intend that those ideas were leaked in the way that they were. What I think we need is a real honest debate about immigration, because I'm very clear from the Brexit vote, from the conversations that I have with my constituents, that they are deeply concerned about it. We're going to have an immigration bill. So for the first time in a very long time, this country is going to have to reassess its immigration system. And
so the idea of putting of agreeing to having time limits for the non-skilled and skilled?
Well, we need control. What people wanted in, you know, when they voted is to have control over the system, which means rules. Now, quite what those rules need to be and quite how the control is implemented, that's up for debate, but we've got to have some rules. Right. And that's what people want. We need to be very clear and careful that we don't damage industry and that we, you know, take the needs of our businesses and our communities into account. But there is going to be change and there is going to be control and there will be a rules-based system.
And as Alistair Darling and Nick Macpherson were saying, people are crying out for strong leadership on it. Let's just pick up on a couple of the other points that they were making. And Ian Martin, I mean, you've written about the City of London. Mm. You followed the financial crisis really closely. And when you hear these two reflecting on Northern Rock and what was happening with that run on the bank.
Well, it's extraordinary, yeah. I was then on the Sunday Telegraph and I can remember us all standing, staring at the screens as you saw the first bank run, a serious bank run since the war. And then I went
only
on to
10
then...
10 years ago.
Only 10 years ago, extraordinary. I went on to write a book about RBS. And the reason I did that was that I thought all this stuff is happening, and although I'm a political journalist and I think I know about economics, I really don't understand this at all. And then about a year into the research of that, of interviewing lots of the people involved, Treasury, Board of Directors, all the rest of it, I had the horrible realisation that lots of the people who were actually involved didn't really understand it either. And you had a system that was really just... The British banking system had become too big too quickly. It was, you know, in 2000, it was about 110% of GDP. By the time of the crisis, it was 450% of UK GDP, the size of the balance sheet.
Nick McPherson was making the point that they weren't prepared for something like this.
And that was, yes, that's very clear, and that's a lot of that fault then lies with Brown and with Mervyn King. Now, why did that happen? That happened because they felt as though the problems of the old economic world had been sorted, and the banking system was a great British success story and simply wouldn't fall over. And one of the recurring themes of finance in the last few centuries is that it is part of the cycle. You get over-optimism, excitement, and you have to build a system. The system is safer now, I should add. Right. You have to build a system that can resolve the failure of banks and deal with an emergency.
I wish Gordon Brown was here to take issue, if he wanted, with
he
your
idea.
I don't
agree
idea.
On the subject.
No, I'm sure you don't. Jenny, just quickly on Northern Rock, your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a very... I mean, for people in the North East, we're still quite hurt about what happened with Northern Rock, because many people in the Northeast were small investors in that bank, and the Northern Rock Foundation supported many community organisations throughout the region, and it was a source of huge pride. They sponsored our football team. You know, Northern Rock meant an awful lot to the Northeast, and we are still, you know, we still regret what happened, and I think, you know, there is a real sense of loss still in the North because of it.
Let's take a look at the papers now. We've got the front pages in, Kate McCann, and, of course, the storms and the situation in Florida is dominating, isn't it?
Yeah, Florida is dominating most of the front pages today. Obviously, the hurricane is kind of sweeping through at the moment, so we'll wake up in the morning and see exactly what's happening, the latest on that. But the Daily Mail has an interesting front page. Their headline is Torment of the Hurricane Brits. And they're talking about how victims of Irma have been abandoned. This is interesting because last week the government was under pressure from actually some of its own MPs. Tom Tugendhat wrote a letter saying that not enough had been done in the British Virgin Islands to really get ahead of this problem. The French had troops on the ground and there was some criticism of the government. I think they're sort of getting on top of it now. They've sent lots of troops, lots of supplies out there. But those questions will, I think, linger into this coming week.
Some question now that there is really unrest and a lot of violence on the streets in the British Virgin Islands.
Yes, and anger, I think, that not enough has been done quickly enough and that people don't feel like the UK has been on top of the issue, as I said. So I think that will go ahead into next week. There are a couple of other issues around. The Mirror has an interesting story about Michael Fallon, the Defence Secretary, saying that London is actually closer to North Korea than LA. This is obviously in the context of, you know, possibility of nuclear war or, you know, conflict between America and North Korea. He's been on the radio and on the TV this morning warning that there's a growing risk of miscalculation or accident actually triggering nuclear war. So it may not be intentional. It may happen by accident. I think North Korea is an issue, again, that we're going to continue grappling with in the coming weeks as people try and figure out what exactly can be done about it.
And as a former military man, in 10 seconds, James, your view on that?
Well, I think that if this time last year I'd said to you that we would be less focused on the Middle East and more focused on the Far East in terms of potential conflict areas, you'd have probably thought I was crazy. But it just goes to show that we need to have a defence posture which looks at all eventualities, not just the stuff in the immediate future.
James Cleverly, thank you. Kate McCann, Jenny Chapman and Ian Martin. Thanks all very much. Join us again same time next week if you can. For now, from all of us on the programme, good night and thanks for listening.
There are many more Radio 4 news and current affairs programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.